Don't let the sun. Hi guys, welcome back to another episode of AUP Radio on WRP. Today we are going to hear two wonderful episodes. The first, World of Intimacy, as Isabel and her father talk about how to have a successful marriage. And next, we are going to hear Stay With Me Here, Political Current Event with Jacob and Aaron. Enjoy the show.
Don't let the sun catch you lying. Lying at my front door. Daddy's done turned salty, and baby, you made him so sore. You can cry, cry, cry. Yes, baby, you can wail. Beat your head on the pavement. Till a man comes and throws you in jail. Don't let the sun catch you crying. Crying at my front door. You done your daddy dirty. I tell you, he just don't want you no sun catch you lying. Lying at my front door. Daddy's done turned salty. Baby, you made him so sore. Whoa. You know you done me dirty now, and I just don't want you no more.
Hello and welcome to The World of Intimacy. I'm your host, Isabel Armstrong, and you're listening to WRP. Today I have a very, very special guest with me, my very own father. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, hello, I'm Dave Armstrong.
And I'm Isabel Armstrong, hence the...
Hope's the Armstrong.
Yeah, oh, sorry. So today I have a very special podcast for you all, kind of following the series of love, healthy love, and examples and advice from those who are in love. So today's podcast will be very different from the rest because we have an older and wiser perspective with us. You, not to make you age conscious, but you are the wisest and oldest guest I've had on my podcast so far. So it'll be an interesting and much needed perspective. So we'll get into some talk about marriage and advice about that. So I want to start with maybe something a little more general. For you, what denotes a happy and successful marriage?
Well, I would say, I remember some advice way back in the day that a marriage, I think like any relationship that's going to be successful, is not, you know, a 50-50 deal. You know, it's 100-100, right? So, I mean, each participant, each person is literally putting all of themselves into it, without this idea that, you know, not even you're meeting me halfway. Of course, that's going to be an issue and can be, of course, in practical life. But just as a sort of general philosophical idea, a marriage is a relationship in which both people just like diving all in, you know, without condition, without limits, and without expectations.
Hmm.
You know, as hard as that might be to accomplish, that's the ideal, and that's what would make a successful relationship.
Yeah, that ability to go all in, right, and to that takes sacrifice, right, but it also, you gain something back because you're both giving 100%.
For sure, yeah. You need to have something back, of course.
Oh, right? Of course.
But I mean, if you give, you know, like faithfully the 100%, you give all of yourself, then you're more likely to get that back also.
Yeah.
So that you're not spending a lot of time in this questioning zone of, okay, you know, did I get my whatever? My balance, my, you know, recompense or whatever.
Yeah.
You're not thinking of it in transactional terms. You're just going all in.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I love that because that gets to, like, this idea of vulnerability as a whole, right? Of, like, you can only get the good stuff, so-called, in life, whether that be within your own emotions or socially, if you submit yourself fully to the chances of being shot down, like, to you know, run off that cliff and really go for it. Only then can you succeed, so...
Fully agree.
So if you're holding yourself back, it gets in the way of true connection.
100%.
I like that. And so kind of getting in more specific and I guess more strategic, what are some strategies and methods of communication that you found particularly effective to foster love and understanding in your marriage?
Well, there's one approach that we've used, mm-hmm. Federica, my wife, of now... It'll be 25 years next year.
Wow.
have used for most of our marriage now. And it's something that we took on board, you know, during a difficult time in the relationship. And there's a process, you know, it's basically called a dialogue. And it has these four components, if I remember right. So, you know, you literally start off saying, you know, do you want to have a dialogue? And that is already it's an opening in which the other person can say, no, and I'm not ready to have it now, right?
Mm-hmm. So you're asking for consent even
exactly,
to get into this
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And if the person were to say, no, let's do it later, or I'm just not up to this, then you would respect that and circle back or make an appointment to have the dialogue. Okay, mm-hmm. So then once you have... the situation set, you're going to have the dialogue, then you lay out your, you know, your case. One party lays out his or her case, what the issue is. Then the other person repeats it back and then says, did I get that? So that's the mirroring part.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would say, yeah, okay, I heard what I told you in you reciting it back to me. And then the person will say, is there more to that? So then you're off, you know, offering a chance to even say more to further elaborate.
Mm.
And then the other party validates. So you say, okay, if I heard you, what you said is blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. Yes, does that, you know, again, validating, does that sound like what your concern is, your issue? Mm. Yes. Then you go to the empathy piece. So you then want to say, wow, okay, I heard that. It must really hurt you. I can see where that would hurt you, whatever. There's different ways you can express that language to validate the, you know, what they are feeling.
Right.
And then, you know, finally, you know, you would acknowledge some action that you're willing to do on your part to address that.
Okay.
So, you know, that's this dialogue has really been, in fact, I've, you know, credited sometimes with saving, you know, the marriage, you know, from, you know, again, it was this difficult period. So that's one technique that, you know, I would really advise folks to to take on. And, you know, it's basic listening, right?
You
mentioned consent. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this. This is just one that we picked up from this particular process that we entered into together. Mm-hmm. And it's lasted all these years. So, I mean, I also try to use it, you know, in other situations, you know, with communicating with colleagues or what have you.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I think it's because you're actively listening, and then you're showing the other person just how much you're actively listening by kind of, yeah. I mean, it reminds me of like when you're studying for a test, right? And you read something, and then to make sure that you've understood that part of the textbook correctly, you might regurgitate it back to a friend or you know someone else in the class to be like, wait, let me make sure that I got that right, and kind of speak it out. And you're kind of doing that with someone is presenting you with like, this is what I'm feeling, and you're saying, okay, let me like really hold space for that and make sure that I'm hearing you right. And like, because I mean, what I'm learning a lot now when I'm studying to become a marriage therapist is this idea of, yeah, like what marriage therapists are often are, they're a record, the same way that you have a record in you know the courts system. You have one in relationship conflicts, because things can snowball and be misinterpreted, and you don't have time to say wait. How did person A interpret what person B said, and how did that in turn affect what they're now saying? Right, you don't have that pause when two people are kind of in the moment fighting, and so things can become caricatures of themselves without the other even realizing. So I like that, because you take time to make sure you're on the same page about what one person is saying, and making sure the other person can understand. And then you're also taking time to, just as you said, empathize and say, and validate and say, you know, I'm so sorry you feel that way. And like, you know, the kind of the nail in the head video that you mm-hmm. I think showed me
yeah,
many years ago,
that
you know, this ad where this woman has a nail in her head, and she walks in and her husband instantly is trying to problem solve. She goes, I have this headache, and he's trying to tell her like, you have a nail in your head. And finally he just says, I'm so sorry you have a headache, honey. And she goes, thank you, I just wanted my emotions validated. So, and it's nice that, yeah, at the end you said you might strategize a little bit and say, okay, what can I do for you? But you make sure to put in the work to listen, understand, and empathize first before you even try to say, oh, here's what I can do.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because listening is such an important skill, and yet, you know, most people, to be judgmental for a minute, I think are just not willing to take to learn the skill.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a very specific skill, and one can learn it, but you have to be willing to, you know, do the work to learn how to listen. And one of the things that I think just psychologically makes listening so difficult is taking in feedback that's going to be negative or difficult for you, because these dialogues can be like, okay, hey, you know, you're doing this thing, you have this behavior that is you know, that's not great. And it's like, oh, wow, really? Is that happening? And a lot of people will just shut down to that feedback.
Of course.
And then it'll trigger, you know, defensiveness, anger, and then, you know, it can lead to a, you know, a fight or an argument. So, you know, the rules have to be clear and followed by both sides. And again, it takes practice and, you know, getting it right. I mean, we all learn how to blah blah blah. How to talk?
From a very
but we don't
early
learn
age,
much
yeah.
about, you know, listening. And the old
That's
what's the old
true.
Joke? You know, we're given two ears and one mouth, right? So listening time should be 2x the talking time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And many of us don't live that way. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. No, and it's true. Like what you said about being held accountable. Yeah, and placing like your ego or your own kind of reactions on the shelf for a moment and saying, let me hear this person out, even if, as you said, it might be hard to hear because they might be calling you out on something or.
I can tell you it is hard to hear. Right? I mean, that kind of feedback, you know,
is very
difficult. You know,
I'm sure.
In a relationship, or again, from a colleague or from a friend or what have you. It's not easy to hear, you know, the truth.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so what are some kind of on the opposite end of this, what are some habits that you have stopped or at least reduced for the sake of your relationship and the health and sturdiness of the relationship?
Well, early on in the marriage, I you know, my orientation was much more around me and what I wanted, needed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, it would have been pre this dialogue and improved listening skills. But, you know, I had a tendency to be self-centered and, again, not be considering the other person's issue. And I also had a tendency to be triggered by certain behaviors. And interestingly, you know, like even the anger of another person, right? So if somebody, if the partner is whatever going off, is angry about something that may not have anything to do with you, but you can perceive it as having to do with you.
I see.
And aimed at you. And then therefore you get triggered.
And you like, react.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, why are you getting so mad, you know, quote unquote, at me, even though it's not directed at you? So that leads to, again, this cascade of, you know, back and forth, you know, evil ping pong. So I was doing that. And I think over time, again, focused on listening skills and what I also call a practice, you know, which is, you know, the last decade, which involves things like meditating, right? Like embodied meditation, so what we would call centering, which includes breathing techniques. And so learning to control certain impulses so that you can give yourself the split second or two that it takes to pause and think before you go off.
Right. And so, become less reactive.
Right, less reactive. So I think that's really key. And has been one of the most important things so that, you know, when those storms brew and erupt in the other person, I can actually find empathy there for what they're feeling and going through rather than orienting it towards
yourself,
me and why are you upset about me or angry at me, blah, blah, blah. So I would say those are some things that have changed over time. And again, I think they take work, right? Some people will say, well, you know, you get older, you get more mellow, but I know plenty of older people who are not mellow.
I do too.
And in fact, even going more, you know, in the opposite direction. So it's just not automatic that as one gets older, you're going to gain some kind of wisdom. Again, these things take practice; they take work. And
one could argue that, I mean, psychologically, this happens a lot. I think people, as they get older, they become, I think, more hardened in whatever it is that they're doing, right? And so it
100%,
oftentimes,
I heard it. Sorry.
You know, no, they're on a road and they're going even deeper into that road. And they're less malleable and open to new ideas and open to maybe, as we said, listening and compassion. That's, you know, an overgeneralization, but it can happen. And so.
Yeah, I heard that put well recently by someone who says, you know, as you get older, you get more rigid, like a wedge of wood, you know, stuck into a crack, and the years just keep beating that wedge further into the crack.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting metaphor, and so it is true. You become, less adaptive and less willing to change. So the work is even harder in a lot of ways.
But the fact that I think most of this. We talk about your practices. We talk about a lot of this has come in the last 10 years or so, which means that, you know, you can continue to evolve.
Yeah, for sure. And
Not that you're old, but you can continue to evolve.
I would credit you could call the body work as some of the most important things, you know, that literally connecting the mind to the body is so powerful.
Yeah.
It involves, again, breath, centering, what we could call grounding, right? Just standing, feeling the earth and feeling your body, all of that work, you know, is so powerful. So
because unfortunately our brains and our bodies are connected no matter what. And if we don't use that to our advantage and instead let that affect us negatively, then we can end up, you know, even all the more out of whack. I think.
Yeah, 100%. So. I mean, it's certainly through modern Western philosophical thought, you know, the Cartesian sort of split, right, between the mind and the body, where, you know, they it was believed that mind had nothing to do with the body.
Which is so dangerous to me.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's kind of how most of us are living our life every day. We have this body we're carrying around. What is it Joyce said about his main character? He lived a few feet away from his body or something like that.
Like a dissociation.
So bridging that is really key to so many things in life. Marriage, of course, subject at hand being the most important.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is World of Intimacy. Stay tuned. This is AUP Radio on WRP. And after all the hurt that happened, baby, you know all to me that matters is your heart. It's your heart. I'm hoping that this love ain't over. Oh, cause I'm tripping over you. Hoping that this love ain't over. And we're back with the show.
So this is a kind of a more broad a question. Any advice for our young listeners out there feeling kind of lost or without direction, particularly when it comes to love and relationships, but, you know, in general, any advice for the youngins out there?
It's so hard to give advice, and that's, that presumes I have some, like, wisdom. Yeah, and it's, you know, like, it's all changing so fast for your generation.
Yeah.
So I sometimes wonder, what to say, what advice to give. I mean, some things are eternal, of course. I mean, again, going back to the 100-100 thing, right? So if you're in a relationship, be vulnerable, give, but, you know, again, you got to obviously be careful about that. You have to know that this is somebody that you can really do that with.
Yeah. And,
it is difficult for me to give that kind of advice, but obviously patience, right, is key. Again, I would go back to this work, have a practice, which is going to help you in so many ways. And I can't emphasize meditation enough. It truly is life-saving. And again, the embodied meditation, various techniques for doing that, breathing is so powerful. So that's, just like if one has a practice, one is self-aware at as high a level as possible, you're just going to position yourself, I think, in relationships to be quote-unquote successful, to be happy, to have good outcomes.
Mm.
That said, though, you guys, your generation lives just in a world that it's increasingly difficult for me to
to
understand
technology, everything.
How relationships are evolving. Marriage is, as an institution, how it's perceived.
I mean, I think a lot is changing. I mean, among my friends, I mean, I think overall, many of us still imagine, I mean, the people who I have on my podcast overall, whether we're talking about hookup culture and we like it or we don't, whether we're talking about dating apps and the whole situation we're in and whether it's more positively regarded or negatively regarded, overall, I think most of us see ourselves settling down. But yeah, maybe we don't view ourselves getting married in the traditional sense for a myriad of reasons. The planet imploding or just, whatever it is that it's changing. But I think fundamentally, seeking love and understanding is still there. So Yeah, I think your advice still stands and is very helpful in my eyes. Yeah. Well, I think that that's... I'm trying to think what other questions I have for you. I have this advice... I mean, I have a question on how to overcome conflict, but I think you've put the nail on the head. But can you talk to me about contempt a little bit? You've talked to me about that before and how it's maybe one of the biggest like evils when it comes to relationships.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, of all the sort of negative emotions that can... just be present in a relationship. Mm-hmm. That's the worst one. I mean, I think, and I forget the psychologists or psychiatrists who did the work on this. It was a couple who did thousands of interviews of married couples, and then these were studies over time. And the greatest predictor, was contempt for divorce, right? I mean, they would tie back the that particular situation, and it makes a lot of sense. You know, when you think of contempt, that's truly thinking the other person is less worthy as a human being than you.
Yeah.
You know, you hold them in contempt, right? Like looking down on them.
Yeah.
And if that is a true state of mind in a relationship on the part of one or both partners, you can see why then the marriage would not be able to survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
It goes completely against everything that the relationship is about, including that 100-100 formula. So, for sure. And one can be caught up in it temporarily. I mean, that doesn't, you look at your partner and sometimes you can think, well, whatever, they're doing this thing, this behavior is contemptible, maybe, you feel. But if that gets directed to them as a person, then you're in danger, the danger zone, I believe. So, how do you stay out of it? How do you just avoid contempt? Well, again, I think it comes back. But whether you're feeling that towards your partner or other people, other human beings, I mean, it's a state of mind that you need to be aware of, self-aware of. And
yeah.
There's a reason why narcissists are sort of the exemplars of contempt, right? Because they have no self-awareness, no ability to recognize that they're even being contemptuous of people.
Yeah.
And that's a toxic way of being in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you feel this is a more personal question, this can be off the record if you want, but do you feel that you learned anything particular from your first marriage that helped you?
You buried the lead. The truth comes out. There was another one. This is why he's so wise.
No, I think that it would humble you maybe in the eyes of the audience, but then make it even better, right? It is a learning process.
And believe me, any of this, I'm not setting myself up as a guru.
No.
I mean, I do believe, our marriage is strong, my current marriage, the good one, and is endured now for a quarter of a century because of the work. But yeah, it's true that I was married before. That was a rather short-lived marriage. It did not survive the classic 7-year itch.
Interesting.
If you know what that is,
right? I don't actually. I should.
Yeah, it's this idea that again through research over decades, just looking at where marriages fail, and let's recall what some 50% of at least U.S. marriages fail.
Yeah, I mean,
the
right
numbers
now,
are about the same in most Western countries, as far as I know. And so around 7 years, that was like the I was going to say magic number, the tragic number,
I see. Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, and that usually involves, where money issues are coming in,
of
children,
course.
The
strainers.
Again, folks are typically getting married at this younger age, so their own lives are forming and shaping up, so there's just a lot of stress and tension.
Absolutely.
About who I am and where am I going? You get into your early 30s. There's kind of an early, already middle age crisis brewing.
Of course.
And so in the midst of that, if the waters get rough, marriages can fail.
Yeah.
And that happened in my case.
Mm.
That marriage, I was in my 20s when I was married, and my first child, your brother, you know, came along.
Shout out, Michael.
Into my 20s. I was starting a business, having a lot of issues there. I mean, it was a tumultuous time.
Yeah.
But also, as I came into my 30s, I had a life-transforming event in going off to India for some months and discovering, you know, a different world that just blew my mind. And I always go back to the philosopher Sam Keyes, who said there are two questions you need to know to get to be happy in life. Where am I going, and who's going to go along with me? And he said if you get those in the wrong order, you are effed. And I got them in the wrong order in that case.
Interesting.
Because I, up to that point, thought I was going to just live this like very conforming life, house in the burbs, the job, the whole thing. That's kind of what I just had bought into as what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And like going to India reintroduced me to this other guy that was always there that I was frankly, you know, hiding and subverting or whatever.
Right, right.
She kind of figured that out too.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, told me at one point that, look, you know, you should just go to India. So yeah, the marriage did not survive, and in Philika I found somebody who was aligned with
was where willing I, to travel well, and was willing to
go on that crazy adventure that it has been.
Yeah.
I mean, not again, fraught many times.
Of course, always, and I think I mean that's always going to be there. I think
sure.
that's yeah. right. I think, yeah. But it's in the work that you do.
Yeah.
That,
yeah. Mm. So I mean, I think the learning from that, you know, was. Certainly, I was a younger, more self-centered person. It was all of that, right? I was definitely not as considerate as I needed to be and should have been in that relationship. And, you know, just all of that. It was certainly there. So, you know, I look as much as possible to myself as the, you know, for the reasons behind that failure. And I use that term intentionally because I do think, you know, consider a marriage that doesn't work to be a failure on the part of one or both of the partners. So anyway, but there were some things I learned from it, but I think most of it was about learning like what I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah.
And prioritize that and okay, yeah, find somebody who's willing to go along came along, and I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, any last thoughts, any last wisdoms? I don't know.
Again, no, it's just hard for me to put myself in the shoes of young folks now and just try to understand, you know, what all this looks like and what it should look like. But as you said, you know, we're human beings. Relationships are important and always will be. Love is, you know, as the writer Wendell Berry says, it all comes down to affection.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what we want in life. We live in troubled times where we struggle to see affection and love and mutual self-caring, but it's there, and human beings will always be entering into relationships, whatever form they take, whatever institutions they are, you know, sponsored by or integrated into, but we'll all be, you know, making matches and wanting those to endure.
Absolutely.
So it'll be interesting to see where it all goes in the next decades, okay?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Papa.
Great.
Thank you all for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day. You've been listening to WRP. And go out and listen today if you can. Okay. Bye. Thanks.
Yeah. politics conversation where we navigate through the noise, so you walk away with all the stuff you need to know and none of the stuff you don't. I'm Jacob Shropshire.
And I'm Erin Flanagan. This week we're going to be discussing the midterm elections in the United States, the COP27 climate conference, and an explosion in Turkey. Okay, so the big story Jake and I have been obsessively watching this week has been the midterms in the U.S. We're going to break down what happened by focusing on some of the big key themes as opposed to the super detailed nuance of who won which seats, because we could be here for hours pretty easily.
Very easily.
So Jake, let's start. What were the expectations heading into these midterms?
So you've probably heard the term red wave thrown around a lot over this last cycle. And really what that means is people were expecting an avalanche of Republican victories in the House and in the Senate and across the country. And gubernatorial elections and all those sorts of things. And there are a couple of historical, like, pretty good reasons for this. So typically, midterms are seen as a referendum on the party and the president in power. Historically, this has been true, with the average seat loss in the House hovering around 28 seats in every election since World War II. I think there's only been two exceptions since World War II. And those exceptions actually bring that average up. So it really is usually a lot more than 28 seats. You know, that seat loss nearly doubles when the president's approval rating is below 50%, for a loss of 43 seats. Biden's approval rating was around 39% heading into the midterm, so not good there. And you add inflation, a perception of rising crime rates, a general malaise, and things were looking pretty not good for Democrats, until they weren't. Erin, what happened?
Yeah, so Republicans were largely expected to flip the House and had a good shot at taking the majority in the Senate. So far, a week out from Election Day, the Democrats will retain the Senate, and the House is still undecided, which I did not think we'd be here a week out from Election Day.
Me neither.
Plus, there were a number of state-level victories, including governorships and changes to state legislatures that have been pretty surprising. And there are a couple prevailing theories for why the Republicans underperformed, even though pretty much everything was in their favor. One is the Supreme Court's decision on Roe versus Wade, which really galvanized voters, young women in particular. Another is a general repudiation of election deniers. And the third is candidate quality. So let's get into those one by one.
Okay, so let's start off with abortion. This is the first midterm election. This is the first election period since the Supreme Court overturned the constitutional right to an abortion. Since then, we've seen 12 states enact total bans on the procedure, and many others have put significant restrictions in place. During these midterms, five states actually had abortion on the ballots directly. Those states were Kentucky, Michigan, Vermont, California, and Montana. California, Montana, and Vermont, they put abortion rights into their state constitutions. And in Kentucky, they defeated a measure that would have put no protection for abortion rights in the state constitution. Montana defeated a measure that would have made babies, quote, being born alive and, quote, legal persons, which doctors were against because it could hurt the care for premature babies who may not survive. Other than abortion-specific ballot measures, Democratic candidates really rallied around abortion access as a specific issue this election. So a survey by the AP showed that for 24% of voters, abortion access was their top issue. And for 70% of those voters were actually Democrats. So abortion ended up being a major factor in Democrats counterbalancing other factors like inflation or rising crime.
Another pretty remarkable factor in this election seems to have been a rejection of extreme election deniers. Basically, no candidate that denied the outcome of the 2020 election won a 2022 midterm in a swing state. And here's why that's a big deal. In swing states such as Nevada, Michigan, and Arizona, election deniers were running for Secretary of State, which usually plays a central role in state-level elections. In other states like Pennsylvania, the gubernatorial candidate, for example, Doug Mastriano, would have had the power to choose the state's election chief, and he lost to Democrat Josh Shapiro. Carrie Lake, another very extreme election denier, also lost in Arizona. While election deniers won Secretary of State in four Republican states, it was largely a repudiation of election denialism in states that will be critical in the 2024 presidential election.
Okay, and then last but certainly not least, we get into the buzzword of the cycle, I think, into candidate quality. So in several critical races, there were candidates that were, to put it very mildly, they were not good candidates for these places. So we're talking about the Senate race in Pennsylvania, where the Republican candidate, Dr. Oz, who was endorsed by Trump, lost to Democrat John Fetterman, who was a walking emblem of the Pennsylvanian voter. Then you also have Herschel Walker in Georgia, who's going to go into a runoff against current Senator Raphael Warnock. There are also a number of other extremists who were soundly rejected at the polls, including Doug Mastriano, Carrie Lake, and Tim Michaels in Wisconsin, who said the GOP would never again lose an election in Wisconsin if he were elected. That's pretty dark, but he lost the governorship to Democrat Tony Evers. I don't know about you, Aaron, but seeing those types of candidates lose seems like a pretty big win to pro-democracy coalitions to me.
Definitely. We're far from out of the woods, but I have to say I felt something I haven't felt in a really long time, and that's hope. Putting party aside, seeing Americans vote proactively to keep and protect democracy made me feel pretty darn good. I think a lot of the time we look at U.S. politics and we see a lot of money and voter suppression and gerrymandering, and it can be really easy to throw your hands up and wonder if our votes even matter. But this election proved, at least to me, that when people show up and vote, these things can be overcome.
Absolutely.
You are listening to WRP.
So that's a rundown of the results, but let's talk for a minute on what this means going forward. Jake, start us off. What are we watching in this Georgia runoff?
Well, okay, so since Democrats already have control of the Senate, they already have those 50 votes needed for control, retaining Senator Warnock's seat in Georgia will be a bonus and not so much an outright win. Because the stakes are lower, this also means the money and the energy that goes into the race is probably going to be a lot lower from both sides than it was in 2020. If you remember, think back a couple of years, and we had both Senator Warnock and Senator Ossoff's now, both of their seats were up, and it determined control of the Senate. And so there was just like so much media attention.
And so much stress.
It was so much stress. And it also happened on January 5th and was immediately overshadowed by the events of January 6th. So just a really intense couple days there.
Emotional roller coaster.
Really, for real. It's going to be low spending, but it's not going to be low spending on the national scale. So this race has already had $250 million poured into it. I mean, that's just like insane to even think about. So both sides are definitely going to invest in this race. I do think it's worth pointing out that for Democrats, it's a lot more helpful to have this extra seat to win. So first, remember how much trouble they've had getting things through the Senate. One more vote means it'll get a little easier to do that. I don't think it's probably going to be worlds ahead. There's still plenty of people who are in the Democratic caucus who are going to be, you know, negotiate for the things they want, but it's going to make life a little bit easier. But second, the Senate races this year were fairly competitive across the board. They aren't like that in the next cycle in 2024. Republicans have a ton more strength in the states that are up for re-election in 24. And so for Democrats, holding on to one extra seat is one fewer they have to be competitive in the next cycle. And one of the things like people I was listening today that people were worried about was like, if we don't win this seat or if Democrats don't win this seat, then you're looking at a potential Republican Party having enough votes to get through a filibuster after the next cycle. I mean, that's how many seats we're talking about in 24. If you're Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, you might be thinking that it's better to hold back, let Dems win this one, and use that money and energy in the next cycle to make a red wave there even bigger. Regardless, though, from the Senate, you can probably expect more of the same in the coming term, including confirmation of judges and Biden's appointees and some squabbling over domestic agendas.
Moving over to the House, there's going to be challenges there. Let's operate on the assumption that Republicans win the House by a very slim majority. Kevin McCarthy is elected Speaker of the House, and to be clear, both of those things are still up in the air and could change. They're just the likeliest outcome. McCarthy, or whoever the Speaker is going to have a very, very tough time handling the Republican caucus in the coming term. There are almost certainly going to be wild right-wing activists who are wanting to get things done that don't align with McCarthy's goals. And if there was a bigger majority, Republicans could get away with losing a few votes in the process of negotiating. But now it looks like anything Republicans want to pass will have to either have the full support of the most extreme side of the party, or it will need bipartisan Democratic support. The question is whether McCarthy will be willing to walk across the aisle and ask for some help from Nancy Pelosi or a Democratic minority leader, or if he's going to stick to the right-wing extremists in his party.
So then let's talk about the White House-shaped elephant in the room, the presidential race in 2024. On the Democratic side, Biden seems to be set that he's going to run again. He said that he's going to have some conversations with his family and close advisors over the next couple months and will have a definite answer by the first part of the year next year. There's obviously a lot of mixed feelings about that run, though. On the one hand, he's been a hugely legislatively successful president. He got the Inflation Reduction Act through, which I think we can probably call the Climate Change Reduction Act at this point, along with the American Rescue Plan. That was a big deal. A few other really significant pieces of legislation. We had some gun restrictions. That was another big deal. I mean, there was some good legislation that went through. On the other hand, his approval rating is very, very low. And if he runs, he'll be the oldest president ever to win re-election. I think his age is on everyone's mind, including, it seems like, every reporter in Washington who has asked him a single question over the last month. there are some Democrats who look like they're positioning themselves to run if he doesn't run. It doesn't look like if he runs, anyone's going to oppose him. But if he doesn't run, there's going to be some people in that. Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has spent most of the midterm cycle running ads outside of California under the guise of fundraising. Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, had a very good Tuesday and actually won a majority in the Michigan legislature for the first time since the 80s. So she seems like she's in a really strong position right now. We'll have to see how she handles that over the next 2 years for sure. And then you have Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who ran against Biden in 2020 and is now his transportation secretary. He's seen as a pretty strong candidate. He's a moderate, but he does a really good job of speaking to Republicans on the other side of the aisle, too.
Then on the Republican side, you really only have two candidates to think about. The first is Donald Trump. He said he's going to announce his reelection bid today. If he goes through with that, it's a big deal. As of the time of recording, he hasn't done so. He, of course, would be a strong candidate in the primary. But if it comes down to Trump versus Biden again, it's essentially a rehashing of 2020, which, as a reminder, he lost. He also lost a sizable chunk of the Republican Party over time. That's not to say no one would vote for him, but he's definitely still the front runner in the GOP primary, but he's lost some support. The other candidate is where some of that support has gone, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. He had a very good night on election night. He won re-election, which isn't shocking, but the margin he won by was huge. Just a couple years ago, Florida was seen as a purple state, and in this election, it was decidedly red. He also got votes from some groups that normally swing further left, which is also significant. He's definitely younger and more fit than either Trump or Biden. That said, he's not exactly known as the most charismatic person in the world, and he's been the center of controversy, like when he sent those migrants to Martha's Vineyard last month, which we talked about in a previous episode. The ultimate question is, who wins that primary?
Yeah, I think there's a real question about who Democrats put up, because everyone on the Democratic side, I feel like, is trying to, you know, wish cast who's going to be the Republican nominee. And in a normal world, you just put your strongest candidate forward and they put their strongest candidate forward and everyone chooses. So we'll definitely be watching to see how that plays out. Needless to say, there's plenty of time to talk about this over the next 2 years. I'm sure we'll be doing our share of talking about it when we get the chance to as well.
That's not like you love talking about domestic politics, too.
No, never.
For our second story of the week, we're going to talk a bit about the UN climate conference going on in Egypt right now, aka COP27. Jake, before we get into what's actually happened, what are the stakes of this conference?
Well, just to be very clear, the climate crisis is here. It's getting worse. A lot of the results of the climate crisis we've talked about on this podcast. So we talked about Hurricanes Ian and Fiona. We talked about how bears in Alaska are having to change their environment to adapt to climate change. We talked about floods in Pakistan. We talked about heat waves here in Europe. There's plenty of things that are happening right now that are direct results of climate change or that are more intense because of climate change than they would be normally. So keeping in mind that it's here, these conferences are really a chance for governments to coordinate their approaches to fighting climate change. And some people are saying this is the last real chance to stay under 1.5 degrees of warming. It isn't totally clear how supportive that claim is, but the idea that they're trying to get across is true. We have to cooperate globally to solve this challenge, and we have to do it now. The last piece to have in mind is about these conferences is that there's a huge equity question that's always sort of going on when we have these conferences. So historically, the biggest emitters were the countries that industrialized the earliest and the heaviest. Think the US, the UK, France, China, etc. And there's an argument out there that for at least part of that industrialization, these countries didn't really understand the climate impacts. That's a valid argument, but they still were the biggest emitters, and you can't expect poorer countries to get to the same place in terms of industrialization and development that these countries are at without going through the same sorts of pollution-heavy processes. So at the end of the day, there's a whole discussion about making sure that the early polluters pay up for having done so much harm early on and making sure that money goes to poorer countries who, A, are trying to actually develop and industrialize now with even more restrictions on how cleanly they should be allowed to do that, and B, who also tend to be the ones less able to adapt to the changing needs caused by climate change and the ones that are most impacted by it. So with all of that out of the way, let's start with the conversation about past commitments. How is that going, Aaron?
Yeah, so a huge part of these conferences is to be a check-in of sorts on where people are on their goals, especially signatories to the Paris Accord are on a self-help kind of path where they set their own goals and do what they can to meet them, don't we all? But countries aren't generally doing a good job of meeting their goals, aren't we all? This obviously varies a lot, but if it says anything in the official ranking of countries on their performance based on the Paris goals, the top three slots were empty because no country is doing what they said they would. So activists are doing all they can to put pressure on countries at this convention to do more and meet their goals. Jake, one of the big new ideas has been climate insurance. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so this idea is interesting. It's called the Global Shield, and it's essentially a big pot of money that countries can pay into that really just sits there like an emergency fund. I think the big payers into it, this initial round of funding, will be European countries. But the idea is that when emergencies do arise, say flooding in Pakistan, like we saw earlier this year, that money can go to solve problems in those vulnerable nations. We can sort of put up safeguards around them and help with crisis intervention. Up to this point, it's mostly been bilateral aid that has been run like this. So a big pot of international money like this new setup is definitely an interesting idea, and it's getting hyped up for sure. Aaron, what about a big deal by the end of the conference like we hoped for last year? How is that looking?
Well, we're recording on Tuesday, and so far there's no deal. There has been a draft version of a deal that's in progress, but that draft included things that probably won't be in the final draft. There have really been two main points of contention, though. The first is rich countries paying to help poor countries transition to green energy. This isn't like the Global Shield. It's more like an investment in green energy to help their development in those sectors. But richer nations haven't historically paid what they said they would, and those poor nations are saying it's time for them to pay up. The second piece is fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the biggest sector that emits CO2 into the atmosphere, which makes it a necessary industry to regulate. But probably because of the cost benefit to the nations that have a lot of oil and gas, there's, as you can imagine, a lot of hesitation to make concessions in the fossil fuel sector. That said, India did surprise a lot of people by pushing hard for fossil fuels to be reduced, which they've not historically been crazy about. So that's good news.
One last thing worth mentioning is the placement of this conference in Egypt. There's been some mixed feelings about this out there, but we just have to note that Egypt hasn't exactly been amazing on climate. And in all fairness, they're not the only one, but they have a pretty bad human rights record too. And there's been a lot of news about one particular pro-democracy dissident who's in prison because of his dissent and who is doing a hunger and water strike to make a point about the COP27. There are reports about what's happening to him in prison, but it's not totally clear. The point is, we have to pay attention to the places that these COPs are held. The next COP is in the UAE, which doesn't have a good record for climate or for human rights either. And so the point is that bringing these nations to the table is really, really important. We should be bringing them to the table. But when you host a conference, you get a lot of clout internationally. And for countries like Egypt or the UAE, they're not really countries that should be rewarded for their behavior on this front. And so you have to ask yourself when it's time to start moving these conferences to places that look like they're really trying to solve these problems and doing a good job of doing that ethically as well. Now we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more. Stay with me.
For our last story of the week, we go to Istanbul, where at least 6 people were killed and 81 others injured on Sunday in an explosion on one of the city's busiest commercial streets. Jake, what do we know so far?
So not a lot, but Turkish President Erdogan called the explosion on İstiklal Avenue an attack, and a suspect was arrested on Monday.
I was actually on that street right around this time last year, and I can tell you it's absolutely jam-packed with shoppers and musicians and tourists and shops. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but the suspect arrested is a woman and a Syrian national named Alam al-Bashir with alleged ties to Kurdish militants. Apparently, she planted the bomb before leaving in a taxi, and another 46 people were detained. During an interrogation, she allegedly admitted to receiving her orders from Syria's Democratic Union Party, which Turkey views as a Syrian branch of the Kurdistan Workers' Party.
Yeah, so Turkey's interior minister, Süleyman Soylu, said the government believes Kurdish separatists from the Kurdistan's Worker Party and Democratic Union Party were the most likely to be behind the attack. The PKK has denied any involvement and offered their condolences to the relatives of the victims.
So Turkey's conflict with Kurdish separatist groups goes way back nearly 4 decades. The PKK wants an independent Kurdish state in Turkey and is considered a terrorist organization by Turkey, the U.S., and the European Union. Jake, how are global leaders responding?
So NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg shared his, quote, deepest condolences. French President Emmanuel Macron tweeted that the French, quote, stand with you in the fight against terrorism, end quote, and the anniversary of the November 13th attacks in Paris just passed, so it's definitely something in the French memory. The U.S. responded by saying that it, quote, strongly condemns the acts of violence that took place today in Istanbul. Our thoughts are with those who were injured, and our deepest condolences go to those who lost loved ones.
Now, the Interior Minister actually rejected condolences from the U.S., saying getting a message from the U.S. is like, quote, a killer being the first to show up at a crime scene, end quote, for their support of Kurds in the battle against the Islamic State in northern Syria, saying that supports terrorism. For his part, he also condemned Sweden for their alleged support of terror groups.
Turkey has seen attacks like this before. So in 2017, a gunman shot and killed 39 people in a nightclub. And in 2003, Istanbul saw a series of suicide bombings. So it's not new to the area, unfortunately.
Five prosecutors have been assigned to investigate the explosion, and we will be back with any updates as they come in.
Now we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more. Stay with me here.
Welcome back to Stay With Me Here. Let's jump into Have You Heard, our weekly breakdown of the biggest headlines.
British Egyptian pro-democracy activist Alaa Abdel Fattah has ended a seven-month-long hunger strike in prison in Egypt. The 40-year-old began refusing water on November 6th ahead of the COP27, hoping to pressure Egypt into letting British consular officials visit him. Fattah was a leading figure in the Arab Spring uprising that led to longtime President Hosni Mubarak's overthrow in 2011.
This next one hits close to home for me. Three football players were killed and two more people injured following a shooting at the University of Virginia, my alma mater, on Sunday night. The suspected shooter, a student, is in police custody after a 12-hour manhunt and will be facing three charges of second-degree murder and three counts of using a handgun in the commission of a felony. This is part of a devastating but very familiar pattern of gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S. I am sending all my love to Charlottesville and my fellow Wahoos.
The Department of Transportation in the U.S., headed by Pete Buttigieg, announced they are assessing fines totaling $7.5 million against six airlines and ordering them to pay $600 million in refunds to hundreds of thousands of customers.
As of today, there are now 8 billion people on Earth, according to a UN report. However, people are living longer and having fewer children, so the UN predicts we won't reach 9 billion for another 15 years. So many people. Other news from the report: in 2023, India is expected to overtake China as the most populated country, and the U.S. will be replaced by Nigeria as the third most populous in the same time frame.
Does it feel crowded yet? France allowed the humanitarian ship Ocean Viking to dock in Toulouse after Italy refused it. The boat, with 234 people on board, including 57 children, had been stuck in international waters for 2 weeks. Those on board come from countries in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. France's Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin called Italy's refusal to accept the migrants as, quote, incomprehensible.
The world's three largest rainforest nations have agreed to launch a formal partnership dedicated to forest conservation. Brazil, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Indonesia, which represent 52% of the world's tropical rainforests, signed an agreement saying that countries should be paid for reducing deforestation and maintaining forests as carbon sinks.
That's all we have for this week. You can stay with us here on Twitter at SWMHPod or on Instagram at StayWithMeHerePod. As always, I'm Jacob Shropshire reporting from Paris, France, and you can follow me at JD Shropshire on Twitter, although maybe not for much longer.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And I'm Erin Flanagan, also reporting from Paris, France, and you can follow me at Erin K. Flanagan. This has been Stay With Me Here. Join us next week for more. Thanks.
You are listening to AUP Radio on WRP.